Hello and welcome to episode 3 of The Gambling Files, Too Long Didn't Read, TLDR. This week we have John, as always, in the co-seat. Hello, John.
Hi!
Thank you, John, for that, for deafening everybody. It was quite loud. Luckily, we've got somebody else here today. It's not just John. We've got David Bartram, who is co-founder and editor-in-chief of CryptoGamblingNews.com. Hello,
hey,
David.
Hey, guys. Great to be here.
Excellent. So, David, what we always like to do is have somebody introduce themselves and just kind of lay out their credentials. So, who are you? What do you do?
Cool. I'm David Bartram, as you said. I've been working at what I guess you'd call the intersection of crypto and gaming for the last few years. The gaming side for quite a while now. The crypto side since about 2017, when this stuff really started to take off. For the last couple of years, I've been editing CryptoGamblingNews.com, which is a news site which reports on, I guess, what you would call the high-risk crypto sector. You could say that all crypto is high-risk. That would probably be fair as well. But we focus on crypto casinos, trading, decentralized finance, NFTs, basically anything where you can either make a fortune or lose anything, or lose everything in the blink of an eye.
That must be very exciting, and there's always something to write about.
Yeah, it's a crazy sector. It's a little bit murky, is probably fair to say. It's very grey is another way to put it, but it's an exciting place to be at the moment. It's a place where almost anything and everything happens. There's a lot of money to be made, but there's also a lot of money to be lost. There's new products coming out all the time. It's a really exciting place.
So for our listeners then, it's very much like the early days of online gambling is what it sounds exactly like.
Pretty much, yeah. You could say late 90s, early 2000s online gambling. Not many rules, people trying out new things, not always working, but there's clearly potential there. And what we're starting to see is some more serious people, more serious organizations entering this space for the first time, and the standard, the bar is being raised all the time.
Brilliant. So one of the big topics we wanted to bring you on today to talk about is the phenomenon of Zedrun, which is a virtual horse racing product that crosses over with NFTs.
Yes.
Can you give us a little quick rundown on what Zedrun is and what's happening with it?
So Zedrun has been around for a couple of years, but it's really taken off in the last few months. It's sort of soared into the mainstream a little bit and become super popular in the last few months. It's like, I guess, what you would call an NFT-based gaming platform. So for those that don't know, an NFT stands for non-fungible token. It's basically a crypto asset that is unique. So as opposed to a Bitcoin where your Bitcoin and my Bitcoin are the same, NFTs represent a unique thing, a unique digital asset, most commonly a piece of artwork, a piece of digital artwork. And over the last few months, the market for these things has gone insane. People are trading them for millions of dollars. You may have heard of CryptoPunks, one of the biggest NFT collections, where literally billions of dollars have been traded on these things over the last couple of years. What we're seeing now with Zedrun, and this is really cool, really interesting, is that people are finding ways to use these NFTs in gaming. So up until now, NFTs didn't have a great deal of utility. They weren't, you could trade them, you could buy them and sell them, but you couldn't really do much with them. Zedrun has changed that. These NFTs can be bought. They're digital horses. They represent, I guess the NFT represents ownership of a digital horse. You can buy this horse, you can sell this horse, you can breed this horse, and you can even race these horses in races and win prizes on them. So it's a new generation of game, essentially. You're owning the asset which you're then playing with, which is something really new and really exciting.
Can I gamble on the horse?
You can't at the moment. So you have to own the horse yourself for a chance to win the prize of that horse. And this is where we get into, there's various questions over whether or not this is gambling. You're not allowed at the moment, at least through official channels, to bet on the outcome of a race. You can just simply collect prize money if your horse wins it.
Gotcha. So what's the underlying technology for Zedrun? What blockchain is it on, or how, what's the currency, or how does that work?
So Zedrun is an Ethereum based product. Most of these NFT, almost all the NFT activities at the moment is based on the Ethereum blockchain. Ethereum is the second most valuable cryptocurrency by market cap after Bitcoin. The one issue with Ethereum is that it can sometimes be a little slow and a little expensive to transact upon. It depends exactly, you know, how many people are trying to do transactions at the time, the value of Ethereum at the time. So what Zedrun have done is they've used what's known as a second layer solution called, this one is called Polygon, on the Matic network, which essentially allows you to keep most of the, I guess in simple terms, keep most of the action on Ethereum and enjoy the security that comes with that, but do other transactions for faster and a lesser price than it might cost on Ethereum. So Zedrun's sort of operating on these two layers at the moment, Ethereum and Polygon.
Got it. So one of the criticisms I've heard of NFTs is that because it's so early days, your digital artwork is basically sitting on somebody else's computer, and you're very reliant upon that computer or network staying alive in order to be able to prove that you're the owner of the art. I might have completely misunderstood, but that was my understanding. Is that a fair, like if we look at CryptoPunks and all of these kind of subsidiary things that have come out, is that a fair thing that it's not quite as robust as the valuations would lead you to believe?
Yeah, well, the thing with this, and this is probably the biggest misconception with NFTs generally, is that what you don't really own the art. What the NFT is more a digital record of ownership. So it's not the art itself. That obviously has to sit on a server, on the sort of conventional computing network, not the blockchain. So the NFT itself is literally really just a validation that you own this thing, wherever that may be. And you could apply this anywhere you want. You know, it doesn't need to be digital artwork. We could create an NFT of a house, and you know, as long as everyone agrees that whoever owns this NFT owns the house, and that can be enforced sort of legally and in the real world, then suddenly that NFT is essentially a contract, right? So yeah, I think the thing to say here is that an NFT is only holds its value if the thing that it represents ownership of can be enforced more broadly. And if that means, you know, turning off a server that means that a piece of digital artwork is lost, then yeah, there are some questions on whether you actually own that art or not.
So I suppose then the follow-up thought to that would be that actually the entire NFT concept is far more valuable for non-digital assets than digital. So for example, if we take a house, anybody who's been through a home buying process, particularly in say the UK or Ireland, where you've had to go to a solicitor and get the deeds checked to prove that this person really is the owner of the house, and that takes weeks or months or even longer. If that was digitized, you know, half the solicitors in the UK would be out of business, but the property transaction process will be far smoother.
Yeah, and you're seeing you're increasingly seeing this in all sorts of areas. People using blockchain technology to smooth these processes, make them more efficient, make them more secure. The issue, as ever, with this stuff is regulation and you know, wider acceptance of this technology. It's still super new, this stuff. I mean, you know, the Bitcoin was the genesis block of Bitcoin was only put out in 2009. So we're only really talking a decade of this technology so far. So yeah, I think there's huge potential in almost every element of live banking. Of course, is the most obvious here, but across the board, there's a million different applications for this technology. The speed at which it is rolled out is going to be the interesting thing, because vested interests and whatnot mean that, you know, certain areas are not going to be welcoming this, because it's going to put a lot of people out of jobs.
Got it. So let's go back to Zedrun for a second, and then we'll quickly wrap up. What's a horse currently trading for on Zedrun? How much would they cost?
So it's very variable, but over the last 7 days, an average horse is going for about 500 to 600 US at the moment, and there's been about just over 3 million US traded on these horses in general over the last 7 days. That said, if you're lucky enough to you know, pick up a winner and a horse that can be bred and create more winners and win you lots of prize money, really the sky's the limit with these. You're seeing some of the most successful horses trade for tens of thousands. I think a couple have even gone for hundreds of thousands. And even the floor price to buy any horse is about $100. So you can't get in, you know, you can't get in the door unless you spend about $100 on one of these horses.
But in the world of the NFT mania right now, that sounds actually cheap.
Yeah, it's fairly affordable. The biggest and most successful collections, you know, some of these NFT collections, particularly the ones which are quite limited and exclusive, have very high floor prices of several thousands of dollars, normally in Ethereum. If you look at the sort of wider market over the last few months, there's been billions of dollars traded on NFTs. CryptoPunks has been the most high profile, and yeah, I think about one or two billion US in total has been exchanged for CryptoPunks over the last few months. The entire market about 2.5 billion over the last 3 or 4 months. That is, I think, over the second quarter of this year, 2.5 billion US traded on NFTs. So this is serious business now, and it's grown up out of almost nothing. If you look back to the start of 2020, this was a very niche area. These things existed, but no one was paying much attention. No one's paying much money for these NFTs. The whole thing has exploded. What we need to see now is whether it will last or not.
Got it.
I have many excellent salient questions, but I'm saving them for the RTFM episode.
And I think that's our point to pause here. Thank you so much, David. We'll pick this up in RTFM, and perfect. We'll move on to our next guest.
And we go to our second guest of this episode, The Gambling Files TLDR. Fenton and I are joined by Gavin Isaacs. Hello, Gavin.
Hello, John. Hello, Fenton. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks, mate. You okay?
Yeah. I'm doing great.
Excellent.
Yeah, all right. Well, Gavin, thanks for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you. And for our next... No, I'm just kidding. Gavin, me and Fintan were talking about you the other day because, you know, not just your legendary status within the gambling industry, as I like to call him, gambling's Bono. Well, hang on. Tell me about Altitude. What's that all about? What are you doing?
Okay, thanks. So I'm the chairman of a company called Altitude Acquisition Corporation, which is referred to as a SPAC, which is a Special Purpose Acquisition Corporation. We raised in around December of last year we raised $300 million. And we went out there focused on finding a company to acquire in the travel technology space, not gaming, in travel technology. And so we've been doing a lot of due diligence. We're working through all of those companies. And, you know, the objective is to find a company that is ready to go public and that by us acquiring them, they merge into us and end up as a public company. So it's obviously been a bit of a trend at the moment, and you know, quite frankly, too many companies have gone out at ridiculously high valuations, and accordingly are trading well below what they actually investors signed up for. So we're being very cautious to make sure we have a well-priced company, and a company that's appropriate to go public. And when we do the deal, we hope to do what we did when we did this SBTech DraftKings SPAC, which was delight all the shareholders by providing great value by putting two companies that were ready to go public together and letting them go with a public vehicle, which is, again, continues to be extremely successful in that instance.
So what's the what's the big difference between, or the benefits of going public through a SPAC versus doing a more traditional IPO?
Well, so the biggest difference is the more traditional IPO, when you go to market your IPO, you can only talk about your past historic performance. So, you know, last quarter we did this, the quarter before we did that. When with a SPAC, you can do forward projections. So you can go to the market and say, you know, when you raise what's called a PIPE, which is, so, you know, initially the SPAC comes along with its trust fund and says, you know, we have in our instance $300 million. And then the company works out, you with the target work out a valuation. And then you say, well, to do this deal, we need an extra, say, $300 million. So you go into the market to try and raise what's called a PIPE. I think that's called, that's private investors, public equities or something like that. And there's a specialty group of investors, institutions, funds, hedge funds even, and people who invest in these things, more of a long-time investment. And they are effectively acquiring shares on the launch of that company for that money. They validate the valuation, but when you actually go and approach them, you can talk to them about, all right, so, you know, this company started 5 years ago. During that period, it's spent a lot of money marketing. It's going to continue to spend money marketing, but in the next 2 years, it'll become cash flow positive or whatever it may be. And so you can talk about forward projections. So in a nutshell, that's the biggest difference.
Got it. And then from an investor's perspective into a SPAC, mm-hmm. it's more about the optionality of the SPAC. It gives you a lot more flexibility. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. It depends what type of investor. So the, you know, when in our instance, we raised, you know, from our family and friends and ourselves, we put $9 million or so up. And then we went to the markets and raised in trust $300 million, which is the trust part of our SPAC. And with that, we listed on the exchange. Those investors received warrants as part of their investment. So they get $10 shares plus, I think it was $1.25 warrants or whatever it was, and or whatever the value of the warrants were. And so, you know, they get to, the money goes in trust and we have a period of time in which to find a deal. They get to vote on the deal. And then, of course, they, if they don't want to proceed, they can redeem their money at that stage. Or if they want to proceed, that money turns into common equity in the company and they've got in at a good valuation because they believe that the acquisition will make a lot more money. So that's the flexibility for that investor. For PIPE investors, you know, they're basically investing at the end of the deal, just before you announce it. So they're putting in money and probably not as much flexibility as the initial investors. And once you go public, then it's a publicly listed vehicle. People can buy and sell shares on the exchange.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And then there's a time limit? So it's like year, 2 years, something like that?
Yeah, for the trust. I think when most of them are around 2 years, I think ours is 18 months. You know, obviously, when we launched, there was a flurry of SPACs being listed and they were, competitive. So the original ones were 2 years. And now, you know, I think I've been reading recently, some of them are even as short as 12 months. But, you know, the other thing about doing a SPAC, when you list your SPAC, you file a document, I believe it's either S1 or S2. I can't remember, S1 maybe. And at that time, you cannot have an acquisition in mind that you're going to do. You know, the whole idea is that you raise the money, then you go and find something to buy. If you go in with a predetermined acquisition, that's not what SPACs are all about. So, you know, 12 months is a short period of time, particularly now when, you know, a lot of the companies went out with crazy valuations, they de-SPACed, as they call it, and, you know, the $10 shares are trading in some instances way below that, in most instances, I think. In over 90% of instances, I think the companies are trading below their initial list value.
Got it. And obviously, your background, your CV is ridiculous. My comment to John when I read through your LinkedIn profile was, is mm-hmm. there anything this man can't do? It's like a who's who of the gambling industry. Why the big switch to travel?
Well, I was approached by a couple of friends who, because we'd done the SPAC with DraftKings and SBTech. and Diamond Eagle, and that was a very successful SPAC. It was a very successful experience all round, and that was, you know, that was at the beginning of the SPACs have been around for 20, 30 years, but the latest wave, if you will, is probably 2 years or maybe 3 years, and we were at the front end of that with the DraftKings one, and they started picking my brains because they were all from mainly the travel technology background, and we spent a lot of time, a lot of dinners going through how it works, what they need to do. And then they said, well, you'll be our chairman. And I said, well, yeah. But I said, you know, obviously you're not limited just to travel technology. That's our focus. You know, other companies or other sponsors, promoters had approached me for gaming. You know, I guess my concern with the gaming space.
Bless you.
Sorry. I'm just, someone in the background, yeah.
When you got to sneeze, sneeze.
Yeah, when you got to go sneeze, you got to sneeze. I lost my thought. So when they said, "What about the gaming space?" and I said, "No, I'm not interested." Well, not interested. I love the gaming space, but it's just that, you know, from understanding the space as I do, I just didn't see companies out there that were really. There wasn't a lot of companies out there that were ready to do this. I mean, you know, you've got to have a company that's ready to go public, and you've got to be able to do it at a reasonable valuation. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on the side, there's a lot of valuations out there which I think are highly unrealistic in the gaming world, probably in the entire commercial world. But I know gaming a bit better, and I just didn't see anything which stood out as, okay, this is a great way to go. This is a great company that needs to go public, and the SPAC's the right way to do it.
So we shouldn't pitch our up-and-coming gambling podcast to you? Is that what you're saying? We should hold off a bit?
No, you absolutely should. But, you know, I'm just being realistic, you know. It's, you know, I'm just telling you there's a lot of people out there that, you know, I you see it every day. That, you know, why are you worth this much? Well, because so-and-so is. Well, that's not really a good reason to be worth that much.
If anything, though, I think we're undervalued.
You guys... probably sitting on a, you know, huge gold mine of, you know, entertainment, wealth, fun.
I'm sitting on a huge
covering a huge spectrum of everything.
I'm sitting on a huge ass. Gavin, thank you for joining us for TLDR. If you want to hear more of Gavin's thoughts on, well, everything, but more on SPACs and other great acronyms, join us for RTFM. Gavin, thank you.
Pleasure.